Good afternoon. It's Mountain Edition, all the week's news from the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Wyatt Orme. This week, rescuers recovered the body of John Galvin, who was killed in an avalanche on Sunday.
Spring is here, and what little snow we have is starting to melt. Experts think the Colorado River Basin is likely to see one of its driest runoffs to date.
Bears are back, and Colorado Parks and Wildlife says we humans need to learn how to protect them and ourselves.
The winner of the first ever Aspen Wards Literary Prize received a custom trophy designed at Anderson Ranch.
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition.
On Tuesday, an 11-member rescue team recovered the body of John Galvin, who was killed in an avalanche on Maroon Bowl on Sunday. Mountain Rescue Aspen was assisted by experts from the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, who helped determine conditions were safe enough for a team to be brought into the field via helicopter. Others were on top of Highlands to spot for slides and act as backup if needed. Galvin was himself a veteran rescue leader with MRA. The headquarters on Highway 82 was full of friends and colleagues who are reeling from the loss. Elizabeth Stewart Severy has more.
Galvin was a 30-year veteran of the all-volunteer organization. Justin Hood is president of Mountain Rescue Aspen.
John is a tremendous force within the team. We've been so sad because this guy has been such a mentor for so many people.
Others in the community praised Galvin's kindness and dedication to public safety. Amanda Boxtel remembers when Galvin took her into the Aspen backcountry on a snowmobile. Boxtel has been paralyzed for decades, but because of Mountain Rescue Aspen volunteers, was able to access the remote wilderness.
I just know him as this selfless, kind man who stepped up to help another. He just gave of himself to help me.
Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio News.
There have been several reports of bear activity near Aspen early this spring. As Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports, officials from Colorado Parks and Wildlife want humans to step up their bear awareness.
CPW District Ranger Curtis Tesh says the bears spotted near town are likely males who are not yet very hungry. But the habits they and the humans they encounter develop now will set the tone for the rest of the summer. So Tesh and others with CPW are encouraging people to contain garbage, move bird feeders out of reach, and lock windows and doors.
Same things apply now that apply in the middle of the summer. Because if they learn the behavior early, like now, you know, it's going to continue throughout the whole entire summer.
Last year, CPW put down 19 bears in the upper Roaring Fork Valley. Tesh says he'd like to see that number drop. In addition to bear awareness, Tesh says it's critical in the early spring to keep pets on leashes and avoid closed trails to protect elk and deer during calving season. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Last Friday, Congressman Scott Tipton and Senator Cory Gardner held a press conference with David Bernhardt, the Deputy Secretary of the Interior in Grand Junction. The federal government is returning oil and gas money to several counties in western Colorado.
The federal government will return $18 million to Garfield, Rio Blanco, Moffitt, and Mesa counties. It's money that was not used in cleaning up an area west of Rifle called Anvil Points. The U.S. Navy used the area for oil shale research. When the operation was discontinued, a cleanup was paid for with oil and gas royalties. Garfield County will get nearly seven of the $18 million, and according to County Commissioner John Martin, it'll go into a reserve fund.
The Colorado River Basin is likely to see one of its driest runoffs ever this spring, according to federal forecasters. Luke Runyon has more.
As the winter has progressed, water managers, farmers, and cities have hoped for a miracle month to boost the dwindling snowpack which ultimately feeds the river. Those storms never quite materialized. And now, a few days into what's considered the spring runoff period, there's a less than 3% chance we'll get back to a normal snowpack. This pattern will feel familiar to those who watch the Colorado River closely. Of the 15 driest years on record, 9 have occurred since the year 2000. If the current forecasts hold, this would be the 6th driest year on record for the river. I'm Luke Runyon.
ArtSpace is a nonprofit that looks at building affordable spaces for a community's arts and culture sector. Last week, it gave the town of Carbondale recommendations on creating more housing for artists. Here's Kristen.
In a visit to Carbondale in December, ArtSpace consultants met with leaders from the arts community and local government. During those meetings, many community members asked for affordable studios and event spaces in addition to housing. Last week, ArtSpace released their findings from that visit. The organization recommends that Carbondale build a mixed-use, affordable artist housing development. Ideally, the development would have live-work housing for artists on its upper floors and classrooms, collaborative space, and commercial space on the ground floor. ArtSpace identified three potential locations for this development: the vacant lot next to Saw Studios near the Rio Grande Trail, a lot near the new City Market site, or a parcel in the Carbondale Industrial Park. In order to build the project, ArtSpace recommends that Carbondale reach out to community partners and private donors and look at federal and state funding programs. As a next step, ArtSpace proposes Carbondale conduct an arts market study that would look at details like rent costs in the proposed development and which site is preferred.
Mohsin Hamid is the winner of the first ever Aspen Words Literary Prize. He'll receive a custom trophy designed by Michael Lorsung, a studio coordinator at Anderson Ranch Arts Center. Claire Woodcock has more.
When the Aspen Institute approached the ranch to see if there would be anyone interested in creating a trophy for the Aspen Words Literary Prize, sculpture studio coordinator Michael Lorsung leapt at the chance.
This isn't sort of typically part of my studio practice, designing awards and that sort of thing.
He knew the design look had to be special, so he went digital, having a computer tell a machine what to do. He started by choosing one of the mid-layers, a material called corian.
It's actually a countertop material. It's a material that's used as a substitute for granite because it's really dense, it's super durable, and it's a really easy material to machine.
The digital rendering is brought to fruition by the CNC router machine. CNC stands for Computer Numerical Control. It's basically like a 3D printer, except reductive. It uses that same kind of technology to position itself as it makes cuts into the corian.
It'll go wherever I tell it to, providing I give it the right instructions. I can make this form 100 times if I want to, and it'll do the same thing every time.
Lorsung says it's important for artists to embrace this type of technology. The completed trophy is meant to look like a book. The trophy will be presented to the Aspen Words Literary Prize recipient, Claire Woodcock, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
The community can help create large planter pots for the Latino Folk Art Garden this weekend. Kristen has the story.
Community members can come together to build and paint six large clay pots at the Carbondale Clay Center Friday through Sunday. After they are constructed, the pots will be planted with herbs and vegetables for visitors. Carlos Ulloa Jaquez, a volunteer coordinator for the garden, says the community art contribution is meant to give people a sense of pride.
We might not be experts, and the pots that we do might not be perfect looking, but it is a way to bring ownership to everyone who's willing to be involved.
The Latino Folk Art Garden is set to open in May. This is one of three parks along the Rio Grande Artway, a one-mile stretch of the Rio Grande Trail running through Carbondale. The clay pots will be built Friday through Sunday, starting at 1 each day.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Kristen Kay. Wyatt, if someone hears something right here on Mountain Edition and they want to hear it again, how can they do it?
Go to our Facebook page. And once you're there, feel free to like it.
There you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly.
This week, you can also hear about e-bikes, electric vehicle charging, and all the discussions our local governments are having about the future of our transportation.
Check it out by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook. Pickens County officials are working to connect Carbondale to Crested Butte with a trail that would run through the Crystal Valley. Open Space and Trails staff has a draft plan in the works, and it goes far beyond the trail route. The county's Open Space Board and commissioners reviewed the document at a joint meeting on Tuesday. Reporter Elizabeth Stewart-Severy sat down in the studio with host Carolyn Heldman. They started by discussing what the planning document entails.
Well, it's a really extensive document. It's 270 pages long. It covers everything from the history of the valley to the route that the trail might ultimately take. There are plans in there for habitat improvement projects in places like Philoha Meadows and Redwind Point, which are both open space properties with high-quality wildlife habitat. There are projects to restore some riparian areas along the Crystal River, and open space staff plans to monitor sensitive wildlife in that corridor, including bighorn sheep, elk, and raptors. They also have indicated that they'll spend money on studies to understand things like noxious weeds that are moving into some areas of the valley, and on education and outreach to be sure that people are good stewards of these public lands. Much of this stems from concerns that Open Space and Trails staff heard during the public outreach process as they worked to put this document together. So many people commented that they want to be sure that wildlife is protected as staff plans this trail, and some are really concerned that a trail might impact sensitive wildlife like the bighorn sheep, whose numbers are already declining in this valley.
Sounds like they've done a lot to already mitigate that problem. How might this trail impact wildlife?
Yeah, so Open Space staff says they've based their recommendations for each segment on environmental studies, engineering cost, and also public comments. I spoke with Gary Tenenbaum, who's director of Open Space and Trails. He told me they've analyzed any ecological impacts extensively, and they feel confident that they can manage effectively to mitigate the impacts through things like seasonal closures and the habitat improvement projects that I mentioned. But there are still some people and organizations who are concerned about potential impacts.
So what concerns or issues are still out there?
Well, the most vocal group who's showing concern about this project is Wilderness Workshop. I spoke with Will Rausch, who's their conservation director, and he praised a lot of the plans for habitat improvements and wildlife monitoring, but he says there are still some sticking points on the route that county staff is recommending.
It's kind of a mixed bag. In several places, they made some decisions that we think were really ecologically minded. And then in some others, you know, we think that they chose an alignment that's less friendly to wildlife.
He acknowledges there that much of the route is totally fine. So what are the specific concerns?
Yeah, there are places where Rausch and others wish that Open Space was taking more precautions. Not necessarily always that the science shows a trail would do damage, but just that it's close to sensitive wildlife habitat and they'd like to see more caution. So Rausch mentioned a few key areas, including Redwind Point, which is open space land, and the base of McClure Pass, among others. So, for example, near the base of McClure Pass, Rausch says there are big chunks of unfragmented habitat, basically untouched land. But there is currently a trail there. And when I spoke with Gary Tenenbaum, he pointed out that the trail does fragment the habitat, and that trail is actually an old road. But still, Rausch is concerned that an improved trail through there would mean more use and more stress on wildlife.
So what comes out of the meeting today? Is this the day that they approve the plan and begin work maybe afterwards?
Well, the commissioners might agree today to move forward with the public process. That would be releasing the draft plan for public comment. It looks like they may take another meeting to review the document before that happens. Once it's released for public comment, it's still a long process. This is a 20-year plan.
Wow.
That's because of the costs and the complexity. So Open Space and Trails has put together a tentative timeline that phases in the work. They plan to start kind of at the top of McClure Pass with that final segment that would connect to the work that's happening on the Gunnison side of the pass. That would be a single track trail going over McClure Pass. And that work could start in 2020. But again, there's a really long process ahead. This stretch involves U.S. Forest Service land as well. So that means more permitting, more public process to come.
Okay. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Anytime.
By most measures, the American Southwest is in its 18th year of drought. And that's leading some to ask, if a drought lasts that long, does it need a new name? Luke Runyon took that question to farmers near the Four Corners.
From the roof of Chuck McAfee's adobe farmhouse in southwestern Colorado, you can see into three other states, Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. The one thing we can't see is any snow.
And right out through there for about a couple miles is a great cross-country ski trail, but that hasn't been used this winter either. No snow.
McAfee grew up here, the son and grandson of farmers. At 76 years old, he now works with a rancher to run cattle on his land. And that land is dry. In his front yard, dead, twisted pinyon trees are a reminder of the last winter that was as dry as this one.
Everybody talks about 2001, 2002, And so that one was a very dry time, just like this is. This is appearing to me to be scarier and worse.
Without snow, water supplies diminish. And without irrigation, farming here is close to impossible.
Drought is often viewed as a lack of water, and it's viewed as a temporary situation.
Brad Udall is a climate and water researcher at Colorado State University. He recently published a paper with other academics within the Colorado River Research Group. It says our conversations about drought in the Southwest need to change.
Some people phrase it the new normal. The problem with that phrasing is it implies that something's predictable here. And under climate change, it's a constantly moving target.
And if we use the wrong words, he says we might come up with the wrong solutions or hold on to false hopes that the drought will eventually go away. That's why Udall is critical of some water managers in the Colorado River Basin who, because of political pressure, use code words like drought to mean climate change. At a farm show at the Montezuma County Fairgrounds outside of Cortez, Colorado, the dry winter is on Mike Nolan's mind.
If something doesn't change, you know, it's going to be really tricky. I'm worried, for sure.
Nolan grows vegetables on 7 acres for CSA shares and farmers markets in the nearby Mancos Valley. He's already anticipating he'll run out of water this season. In the larger scheme of things, farmers like Nolan don't care what the dryness is called.
Drought is this thing that comes and goes, and that's dangerous because we should be having the same conversations and being as resilient as we can, whether we're totally flush with water or whether we're not.
Still, Nolan sees the limits of the word drought in a region that can't seem to shake it. In the past 18 years, a couple of wet winters have given hope that the dry times are done for a while. But it hasn't been enough.
We only talk about it on dry years. It's kind of hard to move forward.
I mean, language is how you think, right? It's how your opinions form and how your thought processes work.
Again, researcher Brad Udall.
This isn't really drought. This is the ongoing aridification of the Colorado River Basin, and we think we should start to talk about it in these terms rather than this older term, drought.
Back at Chuck McAfee's ranch, he tells me about the few times this winter it has snowed. When he runs into other farmers, McAfee says the conversations the last 18 years usually follow a script.
We all talk about, oh my gosh, it reminds me of 2001, and oh my gosh, we're really worried.
And then there's some mention of how there might be a change in the weather right around the corner.
And that's about the end of the conversation. What else can you say?
Conversations about climate change are already fraught and could be made even more difficult when we don't have the right words to reflect the changes going on around us. I'm Luke Runyon.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced in partnership with public media station KUNC in Northern Colorado, with financial support from the Walton Family Foundation.
Childcare is hard to find in the Roaring Fork Valley. In Carbondale, some say the town's zoning isn't making it any easier. At their meeting on Tuesday night, the town's board of trustees indicated they're changing this. Wyatt sat down with host Carolyn Heldman to discuss.
So how hard is it to find childcare?
Well, the Blue Lake Preschool, which has locations in Elgebel and Carbondale, has more than 200 children on their wait list.
Oh my gosh.
Now, I spoke with another place in Carbondale that does have openings, but it's not year-round and their hours are a little different. So I think it's safe to say that parents who work a 40-plus hour week, who are commuting, they have a tough time finding a place to take their kids.
So how is Carbondale zoning contributing to the problem? What's the connection?
Carbondale has 12 zone districts, and the whole town is kind of this patchwork of zone districts, which basically says, you know, what is allowed to go where. The Blue Lake Preschool's location in town is zoned for industrial uses. There's a lumber yard nearby and other stuff like that. So in 2016, the town adopted a new development code, and it said that childcare was no longer a permitted use in industrial zones.
Why? Because there's an assumption of unsafe environment?
Yeah, I mean, if you just think about it, maybe a daycare should not go right next to where trucks are unloading and loading heavy stuff. This doesn't mean that the Blue Lake Preschool had to go anywhere, but what they were hoping to do was to expand because they have 200 kids on their wait list, and they couldn't do that.
Is there anywhere else in town that they can go?
Not really. According to Angela Lowry, who's on the preschool's board, she told me that around half of Carbondale is zoned as PUD, which is a type of development, and childcare is not an allowed use in most of Carbondale's PUDs. And then there are these state regulations where if your childcare has more than 7 kids in it, the playground needs to be a certain size, it needs to have a ground floor, you need space. In Carbondale, there's not a lot of space. Angela Lowry told me that the Blue Lake Preschool was looking for other places in town, looking for large residential lots, maybe looking for 2 lots next to one another. But these are extremely rare, and when they do crop up, they're very expensive.
So what's the town board of trustees going to do?
At their meeting on Tuesday, they said they're going to make accommodations for childcare. They're going to take steps to allow it as a special use in the industrial zone. This demand for childcare is not going anywhere. The Roaring Fork Valley is an expensive place to live. Childcare is important for working families. And more studies also show that childcare plays a huge role in getting kids ready to go to school and their overall development. This is one step the town could take to help out, even if it's just a little bit.
Okay, thanks, Wyatt.
You're welcome.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Wyatt Orme. In other news, Carbondale is considering raising the legal age of purchasing tobacco and nicotine products to 21.
RAFTA's spring schedule starts this coming Monday.
And Aspen is the only community in the Valley without an arts commission, but it wants to support the arts in other ways.
Those stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org. Each year, the Aspen Chamber Resort Association holds a community breakfast to look back at the winter season and forward to new business and tourism projects. Allison Bektesh attended the event on Tuesday and sat down with Carolyn Heldman to discuss.
So let's start with looking back. One of the presentations came from the Aspen Skiing Company. No hiding that the winter weather didn't make for an ideal ski season. What were the details on the numbers?
The presenter was Christian Knapp. He's the chief marketing officer for Aspen Skiing Company, and as his title might imply, he didn't want to spend too much time on the season we just had. But he did acknowledge having this off year has created this checkpoint for SkiCo priorities.
You know, it was not the best season, but I'm not going to belabor that. And I think we got through one of the most challenging years, and it's really had us thinking more inwardly about our future as a ski company and our community.
What are some of the things they are pivoting to?
Some of the projects include increased snowmaking, as we've previously reported. A lot of their mission also includes the new Altera brand and the accompanying Icon Pass that goes with it. Conveniently, also, yesterday, SkiCo released their pass program for the next season. There are modest increases to the local Premier Pass price. There's an Icon Pass that's $599, so a little more than the SkiCo Classic Pass or the Mountain Collective, and they're hoping that that pass will be appealing to Front Range, LA, Western States skiers. To ease locals' concerns, though, about overcrowding, Knapp pointed out that the pass at that price point does have blackout days, so it can't be used when the slopes are already getting really tight around here. And as ACRA President Debbie Braun pointed out, occupancy rates during our high times even this year were good, so there is that backstop. We won't get more visitor numbers than we have beds open.
All right, so that's the visitor side of the equation. What did you learn about some of the issues regarding year-round residents?
John Peacock, who is the Pickens County Manager, had some really interesting population statistics regarding the Roaring Fork Valley as a whole. Right now, we have a population of about 57,000 Roaring Fork Valley residents. That goes up to 64,000 by 2025, with the majority of that growth going on outside of Pickens County. There are 25,000 jobs in Pickens County, and under 10,000 of those workers are Pickens County residents. Mm. As those portions of Eagle and Garfield counties grow in the residential sector, job growth is actually moving down valley too, which Peacock told this audience of mostly local business owners that this has some long-term implications on economics in this county.
And so I know the county has lost some valuable employees to opportunities that are closer to where they get to live. You all may be facing the same challenge.
What's the county doing, if anything, to address some of these population shifts?
The key word was affordability. Peacock used this word a lot through his presentation. What's happened as the population shifts to the Mid-Valley is the wealth discrepancy widens in Pitkin County. For example, job earnings have gone up 25% since 1970, but per capita income has gone up 271%.
Wow.
So we're thought of as this affluent community, but 25% of the county's population is living at poverty level by federal standards.
Wow.
Throughout the year, the county is getting involved in increasing access for this demographic to affordable housing, affordable healthcare, public transportation, and broadband.
Anything else that came out of the breakfast that caught your attention?
Well, one change that might sneak up on our residents is the Aspen Airport. There will be a series of community meetings asking the question, what does the airport want to be when it grows up? I think with big infrastructure projects, we've seen this disconnect between government agencies thinking they did a lot of public outreach and then the project starting and the public not thinking there was a lot of public outreach.
Right.
So this is a defining year for how a new runway configuration and a new terminal might look. This March alone, 22,000 more passengers went through Aspen Airport than last March.
22,000 more this year than last?
Right, in 1 month. The community needs to weigh in on what will likely be a $200 to $300 million project. The big questions involve how to use the limited space that is the airport property. So how much should be allocated to corporate flights versus scheduled flights? How much should be allocated to long-term parking versus finding some more ground transportation? Do we prioritize the boarding area versus baggage claim? There'll have to be a series of compromises, and public open houses asking these questions will go on through the summer.
Thanks, Allison.
My pleasure.
On Tuesday, lawmakers introduced a bill banning employers from asking a job candidate for their salary history. From the state capitol, Benta Berkland has more about what's known as Equal Pay Day.
Equal Pay Day is a concept meant to illustrate the gap between what men and women earn for doing the same work. Democratic Representative Brittany Pedersen of Lakewood says she believes this bill will help reduce the gender pay gap, where women earn on average about 80 cents on the dollar to a man.
Just asking, what are your salary requirements, instead of how low can I pay you? Unfortunately, we are much more likely to be paid differently from the very beginning.
While other states and cities have passed similar laws, business groups say it could make it harder for them to attract talent and negotiate wages, making hiring more complicated. On Monday, a federal appeals court ruled that employers can't pay women less than men because they made less at a previous job. That case will potentially head to the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 to hear from NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. She was in the Valley last month and sat down in conversation with Aspen Institute's Kitty Boone.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.